We hope this helps you say, have a happy day.
It's 6 minutes after 11 o'clock, 17 degrees below zero, and it's Monday, the 5th of February, time for Talk Back to Dumas. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Reed. Quite an exciting weekend. What with the dog mushers, the amateurs mushing dogs around the school grounds over there, and the snowmobile races, and the dance Friday night, and the filming yesterday, the film showing, which is what we're going to be talking about today. A nice weekend and a lot of activity for a lot of Yukoners. I understand there's something like 1,500 people out to those dog races, Reed.
Well, John, that's what I would guess anyway, but it was kind of a toss-up between the dog races and the films.
Yeah, I understand. It was pretty hard to determine. They turned away 100 people at the film showing. Yeah, they went from the dog races to the films. Well, I'm going to introduce, boy, we've got two guests today. I'm going to introduce the first one first, and she's going to introduce our special guest today. Helen Horback, of course, has been with us on TalkBack. She's a freelance commentator and a writer, and also very active and has been for some time with the Yukon Historical Society. Helen, welcome once again to Talk Back.
Well, thank you, John.
And would you tell us something about our guest and visitor?
Well, this is Richard Finney, who I think people know now if they've been reading the paper and listening to the radio a little bit. He was the photographer for the Canal Project and the building of the Alaska Highway. And I have just learned that he was with Bechtel, Price & Callahan, which was a consortium of huge firms for the building of the Canal Project, because I can hear Richard thinking to himself, it's not just the road. Then that firm, after the war, broke up, but Bechtel went on, and they're an international
Yes,
outfit.
Bechtel Canada, Bechtel Arabia,
Everywhere.
All over the world.
Well, and it's that Bechtel that Mr. Finney spent most of his career with as an industrial photographer, historian, writer, and he has been all over the world.
Helen, just before we talk to Dick Finney, if I may call him Dick, how was the showing yesterday?
Well, the films are superb, really, but of course we had far more people than we could handle. Through a sort of a mix-up, we got into the study hall of F.H. Collins instead of the auditorium. Even if we'd had the auditorium, it would have been plugged, because there's a tremendous amount of interest, and I have a theory about that, which I hope you'll ask me later on. So we're going to have another showing. I haven't had time to line anything up. It won't be while Mr. Finney is here, but there definitely will be another showing of both films on a Sunday afternoon. I think that's the best time. But as of today, I haven't done anything but just make sure that Mr. Finney gets around to see all the media.
Well, Mr. Finney, welcome once again to the Yukon, and particularly welcome to Talk Back. Were you pleased with the turnout yesterday?
I was very flattered indeed by the turnout, but I was disappointed that so many people were turned away. And understandably, they were disappointed, and I was sorry.
When were these films taken, Dick?
During 1942, 1944, for 2 years, mm-hmm. I lived with both projects, both the Alaska Highway and the Canal Project, and repeatedly covered the entire area that was taken in by the Alaska Highway and Canal.
Have they been publicly shown before yesterday?
I don't believe so. Strangely enough, at the outset of the Canal Project, I was not hired as a cameraman at all. No provision had been made for filming either project, curiously enough, on a consistent basis. I was hired actually because of my familiarity with the North, in particular the Mackenzie District. I'd recently been doing a lot of traveling, filming, writing about the Mackenzie District, and that's where the action was at the outset. And so I was hired actually by Mr. Bechtel himself, the head man on that show, to serve as a liaison officer and advisor, a northern specialist. And it was an afterthought, the business of filming these projects. And after the first year, the commanding officer of the Corps of Engineers, the U.S. Corps of Engineers, decreed that the sort of thing that I was doing belonged under his direction, because Canal particularly was officially a secret project. And he wanted to continue the coverage, the photographic coverage, the filming, yes, but under his aegis, under the aegis of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And so for the balance of both projects, and the Alaska Highway then was on my beat as well as Canal, I covered both projects repeatedly and eventually made two separate films. And although I photographed, wrote, and directed them, they were released by the U.S. Army, produced officially by the U.S. Army. Then, shortly, the war was over, and interest in these projects subsided, turned to other things, as you know, the atomic bomb and so forth, which changed the international picture. And so the films were just shelved. I was given complimentary copies, and they've been screened very, very seldom.
Tell me, who owns the films, in fact?
Well, officially, they would be owned by the U.S. Army, but the last inquiry that that was made that I know of, the inquirer was told, we have no record of these films. So officially, they've disappeared.
So you've had your
copies? So I have the only copies.
I see. Well, why now? Why have you waited until now to finally show these films or do something with
Simply
them?
Because Mrs. Horback, diligent as well as charming as she is, asked if copies could be obtained for the Yukon, in the Yukon archives. And it was arrangements were made actually through John Guldner.
Yeah, and Brian Spears, who is charming as well as hairy.
I was talking to him this morning.
Right. So we had copies made. These copies that are in my possession, master copies, have never been screened, you see, and they serve as printing masters. But so far as I know, the original footage is gone.
We're talking with Dick Finney, who was a photographer during the building of the Alaska Highway and the Canal Project. Helen Horback is also our guest. She's with the Yukon Historical Society. If there's any particular questions that you'd like to ask, and I'm sure some of our listeners worked on these projects, if you want to make a comment or just say hello, the number is 667-7891. If you're out of town, please call collect. We'll be back in a minute.
Come and meet your Queen candidates for Rendezvous, February 10th at the Rendezvous Queen Candidate Dance in the Rec Center. Dance to the vibrations of the Union Jack starting at 9 p.m. And if you work up a thirst, refreshments will be available. The Queen contestants will be introduced, and you'll have a chance to witness all this beauty and charm, as well as have a good time. Tickets are $2 each, and you can get them at Super Value's courtesy counter. All proceeds will go to the Rendezvous Committee. The dance will be broadcast on the Happy Day Radio, CKRW, from 10:05 to midnight, courtesy of Super Value, a community store that's proud to be involved in the growth and festivities of Whitehorse. So don't pass up the chance to meet this year's Rendezvous Queen candidates, February 10th at the Rec Center.
Come look at Woolworth, big, bright, and new. The fun place for shopping, terrific values too.
The Furniture Fair Bonanza at Woolworth continues with prices that'll really make you sit up and take notice. An ornately styled three-piece Spanish bedroom suite is just $259. A beautiful addition to any home is the three-piece corner grouping of two Davenports, a walnut, wood-grained finished coffee table. The price in this corner grouping is $219.95. A Webcor color television set is sale priced at $388.88. This is a portable model, 19 inches. Don't miss this once-a-year event at Woolworth. Woolworth in the Kuan Lin Mall.
Fun to shop Woolworth, there's more than ever before in your fun-filled Woolworth store. Go Woolworth!
Ford's Courier, the peppy little pickup. A truck that offers all the economy you could expect in an import, plus a smooth ride. White Horse Motors, your Ford dealer, has the Courier now. It's a practical, good-looking vehicle that will give you a ride for your money. Saves on gas, too. See the nifty, thrifty features you get with the Ford Courier. Stop in at White Horse Motors, 4th and Wheeler.
I have just found out from our feature guest, Dick Finney, that in fact he's a Yukoner born. Dick, could you tell us a little bit about your own background?
With no difficulty at all. I'm proud of it. I was born in Dawson, August 24, 1906. I was baptized in St. Paul's Anglican Church, which still stands in spite of that. My parents, sometime prior to my birth, of course, were married in that church in Dawson. My father went to the Klondike in 1898 with the illustrious William Ogilvie, who in effect was the first commissioner of the Yukon. I know that somebody will try to catch me up on a technicality, because there was a man named Walsh, I think it was.
Major Walsh.
Who was officially the first commissioner, but in practice, William Ogilvie was the first commissioner. My father worked for him. My father, a McGill University graduate in engineering and a DLS, was the first mining claims recorder. He was the chief recorder in Dawson, and he so served for 11 years. And during that period, he met and married my mother, who was a daughter of Captain Richard Roediger, R-O-E-D-I-G-E-R, who was the founder of the Dawson Daily News.
How long did you live in Dawson? When did your family leave?
My family took me outside, took me to Ottawa when I was only 3 years old. I have, of course, been back in the Yukon many, many times since then, especially during the war years. But it wasn't until last summer that I actually got back to my birthplace, got back to Dawson. I was just like a kid at Christmas time. It was just wonderful.
Yeah. You're a naturalized American now, are you, Dick?
Right.
Yeah. And do you plan to be spending much time around the Yukon?
Apparently so.
Few people have plans for you. Well, getting back to the films, how long are the shows? What are the shows? One, I gather one's on the Alaska Highway, one's on the Canal.
One is on the Alaska Highway, the other is on the Canal Project. The Canal film is the longer of the two. It runs nearly an hour. What is it,
51 and a quarter minutes.
The Alaska Highway film is about a half an hour, 35 minutes, something like that.
Mm-hmm. And these are going to, of course, be showing again. Well, how about the actual building? I understand the Alaska Highway took, what was it, 8 months to build? Or what was it?
Now's your turn to say a dirty word.
Now's my chance to say a dirty word. Balderdash.
Okay.
I said it, and I'm glad. The Pioneer so-called Tote Road was pushed through by U.S. Army engineers in something like 9 months, and there's a plaque along the edge of Kluane Lake at what was known as Soldier's Summit, which commemorates the formal opening of the Alaska Highway in November 1943. However, isn't that right?
Well,
1942. However, the Alaska Highway, as we all know it today, as a as an all-weather gravel surfaced road, with dust put in it specially to just for atmosphere, that was not completed and for another year. It was October 1943 that I personally filmed the tying in of the Alaska Highway as an all-weather gravel surfaced road, and that was near Beaver Creek. The Alaska Highway, again, as we know it today, was built not by the Army at all. It was built by civilian contractors, more than 80 of them, both Canadian and American, building different sections of the highway from Dawson Creek to Fairbanks. And then, of course, the bridges, the permanent bridges, took even longer, so that the Alaska Highway, engineering marvel though it was, it is not built in a year. It was built more than 2 years.
Yeah, and if I can get another plug in, most of the larger bridges were built by the Canadian Army. The right. Americans put up Galloping Gertie down there at crossing the Peace River, the one that fell down.
Oh, yes.
And one other major bridge, you mentioned it the other day.
Liard River.
Liard River Bridge. Yeah. You know, we hear all kinds of stories. I've worked on the Alaska Highway, done surveys on it and so forth. And we've been told from time to time that one of the reasons it winds in and winds out and so forth is variously because they had drunk engineers, or else they wanted to get away from the strafing of potential strafing by Japanese planes, etc., etc. Sir, do you have any comment?
You could say another dirty word.
Another dirty word, balderdash.
Good.
Give you documentary proof, but I just know it doesn't make sense. Airplanes in those days didn't fly that far. Mm-hmm. And so there was certainly no expectation that Japanese planes would be strafing the highway. I don't think so. My guess is that the twists and turns that seem to puzzle people nowadays were because of an effort that was constantly being made to find solid ground to get out of the muskeg, get out of the mud.
Mm-hmm. Which is standard engineering procedure, of course, even today.
Yeah.
It's just that I think maybe with the more sophisticated equipment and more sophisticated methods available to today's engineers, they find that, in fact, it could have been straighter and there was solid ground straight ahead sort of thing.
Right. Speed was a factor, too, you know.
Yeah.
North of Whitehorse, the first 20 miles followed the old Kewaunee Trail, which was a wagon road and which did wind in and out.
Yeah.
For more than, well, almost as far as Kewaunee Lake itself.
Yeah, that's another thing, a misconception that irks me a little bit. The popular impression that the Alaska Highway, this great engineering marvel, just went from Dawson Creek to Fairbanks, where there had never been any roads before. Not so. There were roads here and there that were just tied in with the Alaska Highway.
Mm-hmm.
But very little publicity was given to that fact.
Do you know anything about the first vehicle that traveled the Alaska Highway, the first one to go the whole route?
It'd be very hard.
Was it ever recorded?
I doubt it.
Yeah. And the tote road that was initially built, was that an all-weather road?
No.
It wasn't?
No.
So, in fact, the Alaska Highway, as we know it, as you say, wasn't completed until October 1943.
Right. And even then, all of the permanent bridges weren't in. They were built later.
Yeah. I would presume Bailey bridges were used initially and then...
No Bailey bridges.
No Bailey bridges?
No, they were pile-bent construction, if you know what that means.
No, I don't.
Well, wooden piles driven into the riverbed, and they were washed out in the spring invariably, and then they were rebuilt and so on and so forth.
Helen, you had a comment?
It's as of this year. This road has just been improved every year consistently. It isn't the same road now as it was 2 years ago or 3 years ago, because everybody who's had charge of the road, starting, the Americans built it and they started finishing it, as Mr. Finney has said, in 43. 46, the Canadian Army took over and they started really fixing it up,
mm-hmm.
replacing bridges that needed fixing. And they had a lovely idea. They didn't get very much. I think they got $8,000 a year that they were supposed to maintain the road with.
Mm.
But they had a very cute idea. Whenever there was a bridge to be replaced, they would pretend that they had to put it in another place altogether. And in doing this, they would go back and get a proper grade and cut out all kinds of curves and really do an engineering job. And their story to Ottawa, who, as we all know, would never come anywhere near the highway, was that this was proper grading. This was just bridge approaches, that's all that was.
So in fact...
The Canadians kept on with that. They had a 20-year program, and although they didn't stay quite their 20 years, as you know, they left in 18. But then DPW, another federal department, took over, and in spite of everything you hear to the contrary, they have followed that original plan. The road is being improved every year.
Yes.
Every
yes,
year.
Certainly it is. I've lost my train of thought.
That's my special gripe, you know. dusty old highway. It's the best highway in the world.
We're celebrating the 30th anniversary this year of the completion of the Alaska Highway as we know it as an all-weather year-round road.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Along with everything else that
another
we're celebrating in the Yukon.
That's right.
It's just great.
That's right.
We're talking with Dick Finney, who was a photographer during the building of the Alaska Highway and the Canal Project, and we're going to get on to the Canal Project and show our viewers that fascinating book that's sitting in front of Helen. The program is Talk Back. The number is 667-7891. We'll be back in a minute.
Think of Kentucky Fried Chicken, really finger looking good. It's a treat every family enjoys. You love Kentucky Fried Chicken from the secret recipe made by only Colonel Sanders and his boys.
There's something very special for the whole family on Tuesdays. It's Helen's Chicken Village Family Bucket Special. Enjoy a bucket of that finger-licking good Kentucky Fried Chicken, a dollar box of golden French fries, 16 ounces of creamy coleslaw, a half pint of country gravy, five buttermilk biscuits, and a quart of orange lemon or grape drink. Enough to feed 5 to 7 hungry people for just $6.30, regularly $8.20. Treat your family to the Family Bucket Special, Tuesdays only till rendezvous at Helen's Chicken Village. Phone 77755 or 77757. Helen's Chicken Village.
Pick up Kentucky Fried Chicken in your neighborhood. Colonel Sanders and his boys make your finger lickin' good.
Hey there, men. Be a Klondike character for rendezvous in a snazzy costume from Hogan's. Old-time suits with velvet collars and trim are priced from $75. Vests in colorful solids or patterns are priced from $10. Accessories like bowler or top hats, string ties, Mickey canes, and fancy lace fronts will complete your Klondike outfit. And women's special rendezvous wigs have just arrived at Hogan's on Main Street. Prices on these wigs are from $25 at Hogan's.
Right.
I presume.
Yes.
We're back on the air. Excuse me, I have to leave. That was a friend of mine, so she doesn't mind. But she was commenting that Jack Scott of the Vancouver Sun fame, and who is still a well-known Canadian columnist, was one of the first columnists to travel the Alaska Highway and to do a day-by-day series. She has copies of the articles which he wrote in 1943. That was Mark Waddington. She has photostatic copies of the columns that he wrote via the Alaska Highway. Just before we leave the Alaska Highway and go on to the Canal Project, we hear some other stories that maybe we'll give you an opportunity to say balderdash about. We hear about people coming, or the road crews coming to swamps and the cats getting stuck, and very often just being bulldozed right over there in that much of a hurry as they just buried them sort of thing. Any truth to that?
Yeah. Yes, I think so. I don't think it was deliberate, but as you know, muskeg swamps can be pretty deep, and sure, lots of equipment was lost, but not it wasn't deliberately scrapped or disposed of other than by accident.
Dick, do you remember any of the particular hardships that the men working on the road experienced?
Yes, very much so. I saw a lot of miserable men along the Alaska Highway in its pioneering days.
Some would say,
and most
still
of
there.
Them were black men. We don't say Negroes anymore. We say black men.
You said colored in the film.
That was 30 years ago. It was all right for people to be colored, but in those days. But now they're black. There were black troops, work battalions, coming from the southern states, Alabama, Mississippi, and the like, who'd never experienced cold weather. And at the outset, many of them were not only ill-housed, living in tents, but poorly dressed, inadequately dressed, simply because the proper boots, parkas, and the like were not delivered to them in time. And these men spent a great deal of time just trying to keep warm, building bonfires, standing around them, and they used up a lot of fuel that way too.
Did the same thing apply to the white men, white crews?
The white crews were perhaps somewhat better off, but they were pretty miserable too.
Good morning, talk back.
Good morning, John.
Yes.
It's Georgina Davies.
Hi, Georgina.
Sorry for interrupting your program this morning. But I wanted to let you know that the Mona McLean rink was out at Prince George, and they're staying at the Connaught Motor Inn, room 250. And anyone that would like to send them a telegram and give them well wishes and good luck.
Room 250.
Starts at 2 o'clock.
They're starting the Briar or the competitions in for the BC Championship, eh? Okay, Georgina, thank you very much. We'll pass that on to our listeners. The Mona McLean rink is staying at the Connaught Motor Inn in Prince George, room 250, if you want to wire them and hope that they win for the Yukon in the thing that they're doing. Some of the other, any other specific problems, Dick, the building went
all year round? All year round, yes. Yeah, that applied both to Canole and the Alaska Highway. Both projects were in continuous construction, irrespective of weather.
Yeah. Well, did they have any trouble getting supplies and equipment into the men?
Yes. In the early days especially, the men were inadequately housed in the wintertime, living in tents, and inadequately dressed. They had, I can recall, like Army-issue overcoats, not parkas. The parkas mm-hmm. didn't come in until later. Some troops got them, others didn't.
Were they pretty well fed?
Reasonably well fed, Army-type food, yes, but it wasn't very well served and prepared. And I know because I stayed in lots of Army camps and ate Army food, and it was adequate, but not very palatable, and often served standing up. You'd go into a building, a Quonset hut, or maybe it was just a tent, and with a tray and no dishes, just a tray scooped out like TV dinners came along later, and a flunky would slop down some potatoes and some boiled beet or stew or whatever it was, and then the men morosely would carry these trays to tables where they just stood up, high tables, and they'd eat standing up and then drift off.
Dick, were any local people hired? There weren't many in the area, but any of the native people hired? Were any of the people that lived in the area? Do you know if they worked on the road?
Later on, yes, when the civilian contractors took over. Certainly they hired Canadians, local Canadians, who gave a very valuable service, because they, especially the ones who'd had some experience in constructing buildings, knew about permafrost, they knew about muskeg, which most of the Americans didn't know at all, whether they were military or civilian. It was a new ball game. They just didn't know about permafrost. You know, is being understood today, but it wasn't understood mm-hmm. well at all. Indeed, the term permafrost, I think, was coined during that period.
Now, one last question before we move over to the Canal project. The civilian contractors that were brought in, did they work on a set contract price, or was it a cost-plus project?
I think generally it was a cost-plus fixed fee, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they were both Canadians and Americans.
Dick, you said that the Canal project was more or less under wraps. It was more or less a secret project.
Right.
What the heck was it all about?
What essentially was the Canal project?
Yes.
I can't answer that in just one continuous sentence.
Take your time and do your thing.
All right. Canal was designed to help fuel the Alaska Highway and its airfields from the nearest available inland source. Remember, when the Canal project, when the Alaska Highway was conceived and the Canal project was conceived as an adjunct to the Alaska Highway, there were Japanese in the Aleutians. They'd already gotten a foothold. There was fear of a Japanese attack through Alaska, and so a lot of things had to be done in a hurry, and so that was part of the strategy, was to develop the nearest available inland source of oil, which was Norman Wells on the Mackenzie River, about 75 miles south of the Arctic Circle. And the wells had been supplying a small local market since the discovery in 1920-21, under stress of war need, more wells were drilled. The proprietors, Imperial Oil Company, told the U.S. Army, yes, we can supply you with, we're sure, 3,000 barrels a day, but we won't commit ourselves to more than that. Well, as it turned out, they could have produced 20,000 barrels a day. It might not have been good for the field, but in an emergency, that much, I understand, could have been produced. However, the size of the pipe was and the whole planning of Canal was based on this 3,000 barrels per day figure, which in today's terms, of course, sounds ridiculously small, but it was something. And so a crude oil line was to be laid from Norman Wells to Whitehorse, where a refinery was to be built. It was built. And then there were supplementary lines to carry refined products to Watson Lake, to Fairbanks, and to Skagway. And so altogether, there were nearly 1,600 miles of pipelines comprising the Canal project, plus the refinery in Whitehorse, plus airfields that had to be built, plus a road, an access road for building and for maintenance afterwards. And there were many access roads in addition to what we now know here in the Yukon as the Canal Road. There were a lot of access roads that were built, including one down the Mackenzie River. And the first airfields in the Mackenzie District were built for the Canal project. So it was really a tremendous thing. It was more complex than the Alaska Highway, which was just a road and airfields. There's a lot more to it, Canal.
Was the pipeline ever used?
Most assuredly it was used. And not only did it deliver its design quota of 3,000 barrels a day, it did better than that. It delivered 4,000 barrels a day, winter and summer, for 11 months. It worked, it did everything that it was supposed to do, and then it was shut down forever. That is the main line and the refinery.
Good morning, talk back.
Okay.
Hello, you're on the air, ma'am. Hello? They seem to have gotten mic shy when we put them on the air. This often happens. It sounds like a fantastic number of dollars were spent on these projects. Do you have any idea of what
yes,
we're talking
I
about
have.
In terms of dollars?
Both the Alaska Highway and the Canal project cost about an equal amount, maybe $150 million for the Alaska Highway and officially $134 million for Canal. And today we're hearing about a Mackenzie Valley pipeline from the Arctic discoveries, either oil or gas, which will cost in the neighborhood of $5 billion. But of course, 30 years of inflation and other factors have changed everything. To us today, I think that $134 million for that package of Canal was darn cheap, but there were critics who thought it was just wasted.
Dick, you said that there was actually an oil refinery here in Whitehorse?
Well, of course. A 3,000 barrel per day refinery, which is along the banks of the what we used to call the Lewis River, which is now, I understand, officially the Yukon River.
still call it the refinery area, too.
And you do. Mm-hmm. And it's where all those storage tanks are, the sort of the industrial area over there. That's where the refinery was. And there's still some of the concrete foundations and pedestals on which the various refinery units, vessels, stood.
Yeah, and those are some of the original tanks, too.
And some of the original tanks are left. And the whole refinery was dismantled and shipped piecemeal to Edmonton to form the nucleus of the Edmonton Refinery of Imperial Oil Company.
was Leduc, remember? In,
after the Leduc discovery.
We're talking with Dick Finney, who was photographer during the days of the building of the Alaska Highway and the Canal Project, also Helen Horback of the Yukon Historical Society. And Helen's going to let our TV viewers have a look at a book which is simply titled Canal and was put together by our guest, Dick Finney.
I don't know, you know, this is...
And we're not advertising it because it's long since out of print and you can't buy
a
copy.
You can't buy it anywhere. I don't know if you'll be able to see, but it's many of the pictures are in color. And it's
we have a very good
beautiful
photographer behind the camera out here, and I'm sure that he can zero in on some of those pictures if you want to some sort of to. White Horse and Young. Burwash Landing on Kluane Lake, for instance. That's fantastic.
And that's
beautiful pictures. Is this book available in the library here or anywhere?
No.
Is it available anywhere, Dick?
No, it's out of print.
There's one at Fairbanks.
Could it not be put back into print? I understand there are people who find old books and do them again.
Well, it could be done. It's a picture book, you see.
But they can all be reproduced,
of course.
Pictures
and text.
Certainly something that should be done. We're going to take a break here and get back to discussing that book and the Canal Project and the Alaska Highway with our guests Dick Finney and Helen Horback. The program is Talkback, and the number is 667-7891. We'll be back in just a minute.
That was Fred McClendon's.
The Captain's Locker on the riverboat Nachia has a wonderful special this weekend. Spare ribs and spaghetti. Other taste treats include crab legs, oysters, shrimp, lobsters, steaks, and the captain's platter. Sunday brunch is served from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. and features a variety of scrumptious waffles, strawberry, blueberry, cinnamon, and maple syrup. Brunch in luxury aboard the Nachia, Sunday morning at the Captain's Locker, mile 913 on the Alaska Highway.
A bean supper. Deep brown beans. Sound good? It is. The White Horse United Church presents a bean supper tonight between the hours of 5 and 7 o'clock. The United Church is open in White Horse to everyone of all denominations. That's tonight. Once again, the hours between 5 and 7 o'clock. A bean supper. Bring the entire family. It's going to be really good. The bean supper tonight between 5 and 7 o'clock at the White Horse United Church. The time again, between 5 and 7 o'clock. The United Church in White Horse is located at 6th and Main here in the city. This has been a community service reminder from Happy Day Radio.
Thank you very much. We're back on the air, and we're going to try and thumb through this book for our TV viewers. And, of course, I'll try and describe it as much as possible for the people listening on CKRW Radio. The book is entitled Canal, the Subarctic Pipeline and Refinery Project constructed by Bechtel Price Callahan for the Corps of Engineers, United States Army, 1942-44. Text and documentary photographs by Richard Finney, who is our guest here in the studio, along with Helen Horback. Dated San Francisco, California, 1945. This didn't come out until after the war, I take it, Dick.
Well, the war was nearing its end at that time.
It was.
And the book was never sold. It was done as a completion report, as it were, and copies were given to individuals who'd worked on the project, some favored individuals, and also to the various officers of the Army officers and officers of the civilian constructors, the partnership, and so forth and so on. So, some copies found their way to libraries.
Mm-hmm.
And then the book disappeared.
Who was the book done by? Bechtel Price Callahan pay for the printing of
that's
the
right.
books and the
that
copies?
That's right, and that was one of the final corporate acts of the of this pro-tem partnership, you see,
I see.
Bechtel Price Callahan, which was formed solely for the building of the Canal project and then was disbanded after the war. And this book served as a completion report.
Helen, where did you get your copy?
Dick isn't going to like this, but like so many things that we have at our house, it was on its way to the dump. Somebody had it who didn't want it.
You're kidding.
No,
that's
I'm
fantastic.
Not. All sorts of things happen. This is the Mackenzie part of the story.
Yeah, 285 miles north of Edmonton. This was the end
this
of the rail
the
line, waterways.
Waterways,
yeah.
That's the that's now famous as the site of the Athabasca Tar Sands.
Tar Sands, right. And this was the staging area for a lot of...
This was the staging area for the eastern side of the CanOil project. You see, the pipeline was built from both ends. It was built from the White Horse end, Johnson's Crossing, and also from the Mackenzie end.
Prefabricated barges were put together at waterways and brought up the Mackenzie, would it have been?
Down the Mackenzie, down the please. Mackenzie.
People are simply going to have to see the... It's the same as the Yukon, you know. You go down to Dawson.
I'm sure you're getting a lesson
people
today.
People are going to have to see the films. And really, we are going to have them... maybe I can apologize here on behalf of the Historical Society to all the people who didn't get into the show yesterday. We were simply swamped, but we are going to have another showing on a Sunday afternoon, and there will be an ad in
what
the paper.
Was the, what
and
were
also
the
there was soundtrack trouble. I personally narrated the CanOil film.
Yeah, he talked steadily for an hour, which in his case wasn't too difficult, but it I think it was more interesting.
There's an old sternwheeler leaving Fort Smith.
That was the last on the Mackenzie, similar to the Yukon sternwheelers. That was called the Distributor. And right. She was converted from wood to oil, as I understand the Yukon boats were in their last days. Same type of boat.
How big a settlement was set up at Norman Wells?
Well, there was the regular drilling camp at Norman Wells, then across the river, where it's about 4 miles wide, actually, there was a camp set up for the construction of the pipeline, a separate camp, and there were several hundred men based at CanOil Camp.
Yes, I should say to our listeners, CKRW, if you have a television, turn your TV set on. Some of
never
our listeners will simply listen to the radio during this program, but turn your TV set on because we do have an extra for those who are watching the program rather than just listening. The airfields of the area are laid out here. They're mostly over in the Northwest Territories.
Well, this is the one, if you excuse me jumping in again. There was two sets of airfields. There was the one set to service the Mackenzie side of the CanOil project, and the ones that the Alaska Highway came to were in, where they were in business in 1941. This was not part of the CanOil. We had
That's right. We had
airfields coming out of our ears in those days.
And we were talking about the size of the settlement at Norman Wells. Were there any families moved in to these areas, or were they strictly...
Generally, they were. There were not families. Eventually, there were some women who were working on the project, secretaries and nurses and the like. But generally speaking, there weren't any families.
Mm-hmm. Dick, how long were you in the north on these projects?
From beginning to end, from the spring of 1942 until the summer of 1944.
That's the spring of 1942 was when they started what you've called the Alaska Highway Tote Road, or the Alaska Tote Road.
It was under construction at that time. And mark you, it was entirely separate from the CanOil project, under separate control or management, although the CanOil project, as I explained, was designed to help fuel the Alaska Highway, but they were separate projects in construction.
There's a picture here in the book of the first Army transport plane, which landed at Norman Wells at the end of September 1942.
Right.
Was there a lot of air traffic then after these air bases were built?
Yeah,
after the
tremendous
whole thing
amount. DC-3s and DC-4s, which were the big transports of those days. They were the predecessors by many years of the Hercules transports and so on. They were considered big planes in those days.
Fantastic.
And prior to CanOil, there were no airfields in the Mackenzie District. It was CanOil that started airfields. Prior to that, all flying was done on floats in the summertime and skis in the winter.
Did a lot of the supplies and equipment and materials that were needed, were a lot of them brought in the wintertime as opposed to summer?
Oh, yes. Yeah, a great deal. By tractor train.
We just have a couple of pictures of the tractor trains, as a matter of fact.
Incidentally, let me say that... you can't stop me. Let me say that...
you go right ahead.
Let me say that I helped organize and took part in the first reconnaissance flight to establish the general route of the CanOil pipeline. And I arranged it with Grant McConaughey, who was a great friend of mine.
And the founder of CPR.
The first president of CPR. But he was still very much of a bush pilot, and he flew with us. He was interested in this project, and he flew with us as far as Norman Wells from Edmonton with the expectation of himself piloting the first airplane to fly in a direct line from Norman Wells to Whitehorse. Grant, however, was called back to Edmonton and Vancouver for some urgent meeting, and he deputized one of his pilots named Bud Potter, who is now retired, living in Vancouver. And Bud Potter was our pilot. There were several of us on the airplane, and we made this direct flight from Norman Wells to Whitehorse. That was in June 1942.
Probably the first flight from Norman Wells to Whitehorse?
So far as I know, the first direct flight
from
across
Norman
the Mackenzie-Yukon Divide via Sheldon Lake.
Good morning, Cockback.
Oh, good morning, John.
Yes.
I just wanted to say a word of thank you to Mr. Finney for his very good talk on the Alaska Highway building and the building of the canal. We very rarely get some real good authentic information like we're getting right now, and I just thought I'd say a thank you. Many of us are very sorry your hall was too small, Mr. Finney, for the fine talk.
I'm terribly sorry, too, but let me say, if this is Mr. Ennis Taylor's voice,
no,
I'm here.
No, you got the wrong Taylor.
Oh, Charlie Taylor. Oh, all right.
A real pioneer.
Oh, all right. Okay, I won't make any further comment except to thank you for your interest.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Finney.
Charlie, thank you very much for calling. Good morning, Cockback.
Oh, I'd like to say a few words about Norman Wells. I lived over there.
Okay.
We lived over there for off and on for about 15 years.
When did you first go there, ma'am?
1953. Across the river to Camp Cannell and see some of the old things that they had. They had thousands of dollars of parts and machines left over, and I think probably to this day there's still some. Imperial Oil used a lot of the parts to fix their trucks in those days. They used a lot of
Johnson's Crossing.
They were left over from the war, were they?
Yes, they were. Yeah. And they also cut up some of the buildings and dragged them across the river ice and made houses out of them, and a church, and a store, and post office, and so on.
That is, they took them from Canal Camp across the river to Norman Wells, huh?
Yes, from what they called base camp.
Ah, yes, yeah.
Okay, ma'am, well, thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
And chatting with us. And here's a picture of the of Johnson's Crossing, and that type of bridge that you referred to, I see, is built there. And of course, there's a big steel and cement structure across the river at Johnson's Crossing now. But that's back right at the start of the whole thing, at the Alaska Highway and everything else. We're talking very interestedly. There's a good word.
There's
Dick Finney and Helen Horback.
Buildings still around. Oh,
talking about the Canal project particularly. If anybody out there worked on any of these on the Canal project or the Alaska Highway, want to say hello, give us a call here and talk back at 667-7891. We'll be back in a minute.
And under the B, we have Bingo, Shriner's Radio Bingo. February 12th at 8 p.m. on CKRW, there'll be one big game of blackout for a $1,000 prize. The Shriners will be selling tickets around town again this weekend, February 9th and 10th. The tickets are $1 each and will be available at many local businesses if you don't get one from the Shriners. The proceeds go to the Shriners Crippled Children's Hospitals, so get your tickets and play Shriner Radio Bingo on Happy Day Radio.
Making a move? Then make it a smart move with Pacific Northwest Moving. Agents for United Van Lines, Pacific Northwest Moving will take care of all your moving arrangements. Shipping, storing, packing, cartage, crating, and assure the freshness of all your possessions because every van is sanitized. Pacific Northwest Moving, they move with care anywhere. Make the right move with Pacific Northwest Moving at 3rd Avenue in Hanson. Phone 667-7252. They do more than just get you there. Pacific Northwest Moving. Horwood's Office Supplies on Main Street has a do-it-yourself copy machine for public use. They'll also do mimeographing. Type out your own stencil, and they'll run it off for you while you wait. Inquire at Horwood's for information and rates right now. They have both mimeographing and copying services available. Horwood's Office Supplies, White Horse's complete office outfitter.
Good morning, Talkback.
Good morning, John.
Yes, sir.
I heard many times since I come up here the cost of the canal project in relation to this is the cost of the project up to the time it was in operation. And the amount of fuel that was refined that worked out to $7.25 a gallon. Will you ask your listener if this is extreme or what do you
Or if that's true. Do you have any idea, Dick?
I don't know. You know, after all, it was a wartime project, and like all war projects, it was expensive in terms of human effort and in terms of money in those days. But and the cost officially of the canal project was $134 million. Well, that seems like peanuts today. Talking about pipelines from the Arctic that'll cost $5 billion.
Mm-hmm. Does that include the cost of the refinery here in White Horse?
That included, yeah, after all, for the package for $134 million, even if it cost more, but that was the official thing. The package included all the airfields that were built down the Mackenzie River and some of them across the divide, the Mackenzie-Yukon divide. It included 1,600 miles of pipelines, nearly. It included a telephone line from Norman Wells to White Horse. Some of those poles are still standing after all these years. And the refinery itself. So that when you consider all of the complexities of the project, and the fact that it was a war project, and war is expensive any way you look at it, I don't think it was too much.
Good morning, Talkback.
Yes, good morning, John. Could I speak to Mr. Finney, please?
Go right ahead, please.
Mr. Finney.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I worked on the loading of the pipe that they brought out of the Canal Road. I believe it was 1949 or 50.
Yeah.
And we loaded on at the flat cars at Carcross there.
Yeah.
For shipment out. Now, could you tell me where that pipe went? I always wondered where it all went.
It was bought, I understand, by the White Pass. And I think a lot of it went to Edmonton, but I'm not sure. I can't, I just don't know.
Yeah, I know they shipped it out to Skagway, you know, on the...
Well, it would have gone via Skagway, yes.
Yeah.
And then to either to Prince Rupert or to Vancouver, I don't know.
I just often wondered where all that, you know, where it all went.
But some of it is still around.
Oh, yes, this is true.
One point that I want to make that I think is quite fascinating is that one segment of the canal system is still in use today after 30 years, and
that's the
White Horse Skagway line.
Yeah, right. I worked.
That was part of the canal system.
That was all part of the canal
system.
It's
now owned by White Pass.
It's
the common carrier
owned and operated by White Pass for stove oil and diesel fuel, I've been told.
Right.
Okay, then. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much for calling. And just mentioning Skagway, there's a picture in the book of Skagway during 1942. Were you down? Did you take that picture, in fact?
Sure, I took all of the pictures.
You took all of
this book.
We haven't gotten this through to you yet.
I was shooting both stills.
I
was shooting both stills and movies. And doing reports also, progress reports on the things that were going on that in all of these locations. So I covered the entire area of activity.
It says in the book that Skagway boomed again during that period. How many people would have been? It was an offloading point for troops and supplies and so forth.
That is correct. And this photograph here shows how it looked during the war years. Old buildings were taken over by the army and the civilian contractors. Some of those buildings have survived. Some of them, unfortunately, were burnt. And a lot of Quonset huts were put up in Skagway and other temporary wartime housing. Oh, there were thousands of people in Skagway.
I recognize what I think one building in Skagway, the Golden North. Yes.
Yeah.
What line are we on? Good morning, Talkback.
John, Chuck Haines here.
Yes, sir, Chuck.
I was listening to Mr. Finney.
Mm-hmm.
And that name kind of rings a bell to me when I used to live in Dawson, but that's not the point right now.
I have an old copy of National Geographic kicking around here with a lot of pictures of construction of the highway. Not the Canal River project, the highway. I was just wondering now if Mr. Finney had anything to do with those.
No, I didn't, unfortunately. The National Geographic magazine pays very handsomely, but I never... I've had a few pictures published by the National Geographic, but that's all. And certainly, I doubt that those would have any of those would have been mine on the highway.
No, they're not, but hang on to that
it's
copy.
It's a curious spot, anyway.
Don't throw the copy out.
That's
keep
a
it. It's precious.
A collector's item, you betcha.
I didn't get that?
You've got a collector's item there. Don't lose that copy of your magazine.
No, well, I'll tell you where I got it from, Helen. I got it from the late Stu McPherson.
Oh, yes.
All right.
Yes.
Yeah.
I suggest, respectfully suggest, that you present it to the Historical Society.
Well, I had that thought in mind, too.
Good.
Okay, Chuck,
it's
thanks.
It's kind of beat up, you know, but there are some pictures that are still legible, and there's a few pages stuck together and so forth, but there's quite a little article in there.
Chuck, you were up here during the building of the highway, were you not?
No, I was in Dawson City.
Oh, in Dawson. Yeah. So that would have bypassed you.
Were you born in Dawson?
52.
Were you born in Dawson?
No, I wasn't. I came into Dawson from B.C. in 1935.
Oh,
he's
you're
a relative newcomer.
Oh, yeah, Johnny come lately.
Chuck, thanks very much for calling.
Okay, John.
Did you have occasion during those days, those war days, to get up to the Dawson or Klondike
No, I
area?
Didn't. That's one of my great regrets. I was just too conscientious. I had no legitimate reason to go to Dawson. I was in and out of Whitehorse and, of course, over the Canal route many, many, many times. But I never had occasion to go to Dawson during those war years.
Was Dawson more or less, in that area, more or less bypassed by all of the activity?
Pretty much so, yeah, I think so.
Good morning, talk back. Hello.
Harry Frome calling.
Hello, Harry.
How are you?
Very good.
Would you mind asking Mr. Finney if he has any pictures of the actual takeover ceremony that took place in 1942 at 1061?
No.
You don't have any pictures?
No. The takeover in what year?
1942.
40.
The 1942 one, which has the plaque on it, Soldier Summit.
Oh, Soldier Summit. No, I was not present at that affair. I was elsewhere at the time. I was working on the Canal project, and so I never did get to Soldier Summit during that period.
Do you know of any pictures that exist?
No, I don't.
The Army would have some, Harry.
The American Army.
I'd like to have one. I still own the cabins at 1061, which I did at that time.
Oh.
And that's why I'm particularly in.
Oh, yes.
I was in Whitehorse then, and I wasn't up for the ceremony.
Oh, yeah.
Harry, did you work on the Alaska Highway building?
Not actually on the highway. I worked in other phases of it, old fencing and pump stations on the pipeline.
Oh, yeah. Right.
And I worked on the airport, of course, here.
Yeah. Okay, Harry, thanks very much for calling.
Real good.
Very much appreciated.
The airport, of course, was in existence prior to the Alaska Highway.
Good morning, talk back.
Hello.
You're on the air, sir.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Hello, John.
Yes?
I had the privilege of working on the Alaska Highway, which was being built between Dawson, well, Fort St. John and Fort Nelson.
Mm-hmm.
I packed horses there.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't seen any pictures of pack horses or anything like that. And that's the way it was done there. The Army surveyed the tote road, and then a lot of it was done by air photos.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I packed horses that one summer from Charlie Lake to Fort Nelson and back.
Yes, uh-huh. Horses were used also on the Canal project, on the route of the main Canal pipeline. A number of horses were used by survey parties, and they were also used by the builders of the telephone line.
Uh-huh.
They used horses to haul logs out of the bush for the telephone line. They had them way up as far as McMillan Pass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we used horses there. In fact, at one time they thought that they had at least 500 head of pack horse. That is different outfits.
Yeah, right.
I think every available pack horse in northern Alberta and BC was working at that time.
Right, right.
And I was just wondering if you had ever run across these
Not on the highway, but only canal. And dogs were used also, incidentally, on the canal project by some of the surveyors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, I just thought I'd make a comment.
Well, thank you very much for calling. I'm glad that you did.
Yep.
And there are some pictures before our TV viewers of the oil refinery that was situated here in Whitehorse.
This is the refinery, and at the time, local people were forbidden to take these pictures. The only reason that, I mean, we're looking at secret pictures here, if we were 30 years ago. Isn't that right? Yeah. But Mr. Finney got them because he was the
And also I got, I don't know whether one of them is in there or not, also I photographed the Whitehorse Airport when there were dozens of fighter planes and bombers with the red star of Russia on them. They were being ferried to Russia via the Alaska Highway.
They were being
airport.
Supplied, presumably had been built and were supplied by the Americans?
That's right, thousands of them.
Yeah. Lend-lease.
Lend-lease. Yeah.
Good morning, talkback.
Yeah, I just couldn't help hearing that fellow that was just on there talking about the pack horse, and then I was just wondering if Mr. Finning had anything to do with the rail survey, too, and they used horses all the way up there. That's the axle with the Campbell Highway is pretty well the majority of it right now.
When was the rail survey done? Sir, when was the rail survey?
It was down that stage in the early 40s there, too, but I don't remember which. Van Bibber, I think he was one of them that packed horses up in through there.
What rail survey? I don't know.
Well, the interior rail.
Yeah, all the way from Dawson, all the way straight through, right up north. Huh. I worked on the survey for the Campbell Highway. We used their own line.
No, I have no knowledge of that. That's outside of my experience.
Well, sometime if Helen, she's around Van Bibber, she can get him to explain it, because I know for a fact on it.
Okay.
Over it myself.
Well, thank you very much for calling.
Okay.
Asking about it. You mentioned the use of dog teams and dogs and sleds and that. I'm going to ask you about that, but we have to take a break because this is a commercial station, so we have to do our thing all the time. We're talking with Dick Finney, who was a photographer during the building of the Alaska Highway and the Canal Project, along with Helen Horback of the Yukon Historical Society. The program is Talkback. The number is 667-7891. We'll be back in a minute.
Look into the Edgewater Hotel at First and Main. They have fully modern rooms or relax in their tavern and watch color cablevision. Try the Chinese food special offered each evening in their first floor restaurant or dine in the cellar. Open 6 p.m. daily except Sunday. Phone 667-2573 for reservations at the cellar dining lounge. The Edgewater Hotel will be bringing you reports on the BC Yukon curling playdowns from Nelson. Listen for them at 6:10 on CKRW.
Tenderfied chicken from Dixie Lee, tops in flavor and quality, made from a secret recipe for tenderfied chicken called Dixie Lee.
Dixie Lee is new. You'll love Dixie Lee at the corner of 4th and Steele. Call 667-7224 or 667-7223.
Friendliness and courtesy, that's what you will find. It's the greatest, you'll agree, for tenderfied chicken called Dixie Lee.
Fast and efficient service. If you like chicken, you'll love Dixie Lee. And ask about their catering service. Dixie Lee, 312 Steele Street at 4th.
Tenderfied chicken from Dixie Lee, tops in flavor and quality, made from a secret recipe for tenderfied chicken called Dixie Lee.
667-7224 or 667-7223.
Dixie Lee!
We just had a very interesting phone call off the air from Macaulay Lodge, and a fellow by the name of Nazar Zinchuk, who stays at the lodge, is listening to the program and remembers Mr. Finney from back.
And I remember him very well. Good
and
man.
So they're going to get together around 4 o'clock this afternoon over at Macaulay Lodge. Certainly, I think there are other people who either aren't listening to the show or haven't had an opportunity to call in that were around and working on these projects at the time.
So undoubtedly.
I've run into them from time to time. Helen?
Bill Cushan was at the show yesterday, and he came all the way from Watson Lake just to see the show.
Just for the showing.
Yeah. And they are going to be shown in Watson Lake.
How about
everywhere. When we started out with this thing, our archivist was fussing that, you know, this was archival material and we weren't going to show it too often. But I think he had to admit, after seeing the crowd yesterday, that we've just got to let everybody see them. They're too
good.
Well,
surely that's the purpose of it.
Well, there are two ways of looking at it, you know. If it's shown too often, it'll wear the film out.
Oh, I see.
But fortunately, I have a printing master, you see.
Oh, you do?
And which has never been screened, and so we can get additional copies from that.
We are.
Yeah. One of the things that's always fascinated me, both about the Alaska Highway and, the Canal Project, too, is how do you come by these names? I can remember when I was very young, the Elkan Highway reference very often, and the Canal. How did the Canal name come about?
It was a code name which stood for Canadian Oil. It was simple as that. And the official pronunciation was Canal. However, workers on that project dreamed up all sorts of variations so that you would hear canal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it was officially canals, each syllable equally stressed. And incidentally, Alcan Highway, we're discussing that. One very good reason for not calling it the Alcan Highway anymore is that Alcan stands for the Aluminum Company of Canada. It's a trade name.
And it's too close to Oil Can Highway, which is one of the nicknames for the road.
Oil Can. Was that the official name, Alcan, during the war?
Well, it was popularly used.
It wasn't the official name.
It wasn't the official name at any time.
The official name is still the Alaska Military Highway. That name has never been changed.
Well, it was changed, I think. To just the Alaska Highway. The military was taken off.
I've never been able to find that out.
Right after the war, I think so.
Make the difference, sir.
We'll let you do some research on that and come back, Helen, next time.
I won't make an issue of it.
How long did the Americans operate the highway?
They were in charge until about the end of the war.
1946 was the handover to the Canadians.
To the Canadian Army. And then the Canadian Army turned over to DPW. When was that? I was here. 1964. And DPW has now turned the territorial section over to the Yukon Territorial Government.
Who will continue to do just as good a job, I'm sure.
Who will have it forever and ever, no doubt. Any other particular incidents or stories about the building of either the Canal Project or the Alaska Highway, Dick, that you think our listeners should hear?
Why don't we let everybody in Faro know that you're coming there tomorrow?
One thing I want to say, giving credit where credit is due, thousands of people, of course, worked on both projects, but time marches on, and a lot of them who did yeoman service are now dead. But one of them who is still alive and active in the Yukon is Dalzell, George Dalzell, one of the pioneer bush pilots who helped to lay out the airfields along the Mackenzie River. He and another bush pilot, older than Dalzell, who is now dead, Matt Berry. Matt Berry was one of the great early Canadian bush pilots, dating back to World War I days when he learned his flying. Well, Dalzell belonged to a later generation, but he was a great guy. And I got a telephone call from his wife yesterday urging me to come and visit with them both at Watson Lake.
Another rumor that I've heard from time to time over the years is that the atomic bomb on its way to eventually Japan may have traveled over the Alaska Highway. You ever hear anything about that like that?
Never did.
Highly unlikely.
However, this little footnote to history I can offer, and that is that the ingredients for the first atomic bomb came from Canada, came from Great Bear Lake, from the El Dorado mine, because at that time, there was very little uranium in the United States, if any. Uranium mines have since been developed, but El Dorado preceded those in the United States, and I was told that's what happened, that the ingredients for the first atomic bomb came from Great Bear Lake.
Yes, and earlier I asked about equipment lost on the Alaska Highway.
Yeah.
The other story that we've heard, as a matter of fact, I'm quite certain it's a fact, that there was a whole lot of equipment on the canal project that was finally just stripped and buried, or just buried. And it wasn't that long ago that somebody
wasn't
went
even
in.
Buried.
It wasn't even buried.
Look, you can, all you have, as I did last summer, you can drive down to Johnson's Crossing. You don't have to go very far. Just go start off on the Canal Road, and there are the remains of one of the principal supply camps, supply and maintenance camps. There's still some buildings standing, and there are trucks, remains of trucks just standing out in the bush all around there, just abandoned.
And when the war was over, the whole Canal project was just simply abandoned?
No, not the whole, not the whole
not
project.
The whole.
No, remember, something was left of the Canal project. Whatever value, military value, the Canal project may have had, it was of lasting value to Canada in that it helped to, through the Canal Road, it helped to open up new country for development. And I understand that the Faro mine is an outgrowth of that, that maybe it would have been found sooner or later anyway, but the existence of the Canal Road facilitated it. Airports remain that were built during that time. The among the supplementary pipelines, the one to Fairbanks was used for years after the war until the 1950s when it was supplanted by the Haines pipeline to Fairbanks. And there are sections of the Fairbanks pipeline that are still visible on the Alaskan side, not on the Yukon side, because the pipe has been picked up. And then, as we remarked earlier, the Skagway-Whitehorse canal line is still in use after 30 years.
We have a couple of callers on the phone. We'll ask them to be patient with us. We want to take a break. We'll be back. We've got a few minutes left. Be winding up. Of course, we're going over time with this version of Talkback because we have a couple of very interesting guests, particularly Dick Finney, who is a photographer during the building of the Alaska Highway and the Canal Project. Along with him, we have Helen Horback of the Yukon Historical Society. The number is 667-7891. The program's Talkback. We'll be back in a minute.
Explore the Arctic with Atlas Travel on an all-inclusive Easter tour to Inuvik, Tuktoyaktuk, and Sax Harbor. Go sightseeing on a dog sled, visit Eskimos, and participate in a seal hunt if conditions permit. Leave April 20th and return April 22nd. The total price, $179.50, includes all airfares, transfers, sightseeing, two nights in hotel, and a special meal featuring blubber. There's a limited number of seats, and they've been sold out every year so far, so reserve now. Call 667-7824 for further information. See the far north with Atlas Travel.
T&D's Food Fair has brought in grade A turkeys, 10 to 16 pounds at 69 cents a pound, and whole fresh frying chickens, also 69 cents. Canada Choice rib steaks are $1.69 a pound. Chuck roast is 99 cents, and a 5-pound tub of ground beef is $3.95. In the Food Fair, enjoy fresh produce, frozen foods, meat, fish, and poultry, and all the staples you need on which to run a home. They're ready for you at T&D, First and Main.
The film.
What do you mean?
Good morning, Talkback.
John.
Yes.
This is meant strictly as a pun for the your distinguished guest. He should be careful where he says that uranium come from that made that bomb. For the first thing you know, the Russians be blaming the Canadians for dropping it.
Sorry about that.
Thanks for calling. Good morning, Talkback.
Good morning, John. I'd like to speak with your guest.
Go right ahead.
Mr. Finney.
Yes, sir.
Who was the prime contractor on the Canal Pipeline? Was it NWD or MHKCB?
No, that's confusing. No, the prime contractor on the Canal Project was a wartime partnership, Bechtel, Price, Callahan. Bechtel still flourishes and is bigger than ever today. Price is a pipeline contractor, flourishing also, I think, with headquarters in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. The Callahan Company, I think, has disappeared. The man that ran it, Paul Grafe, is on in years, and I think he's retired.
Didn't the Metcalf-Hamilton Kansas City Bridge Company do a lot of work on that line,
though? Not a lot. No, they didn't. Actually, they did not. I remember them very well. They did get some contracts on the highway itself, but they did, to my knowledge, they did nothing directly concerned with the Canal project itself. I remember the principals in the firm. There was Gordon Hamilton and Lee Metcalf, who represented the firm. And I think they were pretty disappointed. They were, I have been told that they were expecting to get a big housing contract in the McRae area. But the only thing they built out there was a theater, which was a king-sized Quonset hut called the Tita Theater.
I see.
And it disappeared after the war.
Yeah, I spent 6 years in Norman Wells, and I left there in 1963.
Oh, yes.
And it was amazing, the, well, as they called them, skip boxes over there full of truck and tractor parts. And the wonderful condition that the buildings were in over there after all that length of time.
They
well preserved.
Yeah.
And
Go ahead.
Well, I was thinking you mentioned Dalzell for flying in at that time.
Yeah.
What about guys like Charlie Robinson and Fred Milekey and some of those CP air captains that threw the Lodestars into the Wells and into Canal there?
Oh, there were a lot of them, but I'm talking about the pioneering that Dalzell did, and I singled him out not to give him very special credit, although he deserves all he gets, but because he's still alive and around here. A lot of these other fellows are dead.
Oh, no, I don't think so. I'm not sure of Charlie Robinson. Remember Charlie, he had carried his accordion with him and played a few songs.
And the first, the pioneer flight from Norman Wells to Whitehorse, in which I took part, was in an oddball airplane called a Barclay Grohl.
T-8P-1. Yeah,
I understand that they made only about a half a dozen of them.
I think there's only one left.
And the pilot on that flight was Bud Potter, who is now retired in Vancouver.
Yeah. But I was just thinking, I think there's Fred Milekey. I'm sure he's still around.
Incidentally, quite a bit of special flying was done through George Simmons' flying company in Carcross.
Right.
And a man I flew with several times was Pat Callison.
Oh, yeah, Pat. It might be an interesting note. I live up here in Valley View, and there used to be a sign on a tree or a post back here. I think it either said Pump House Number 1 or Pump House Number whatever it was. It was either the first or the last pump house on the line.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if it's still there or not. It might still be hanging on
Maybe
the tree.
Maybe it is.
But, it was amazing to see the Canal airstrip was still good and the buildings were still good. And, man, there was thousands of dollars worth of parts there if a guy could have put them in his suitcase.
That's right.
Yeah.
And at Johnson's Crossing last summer, I found a parts catalog dated 1942.
Yeah, right.
Still there, lying on the floor of one of the parts warehouses.
Yeah, there was we found at Norman Wells, we did take a tour over to the old airport there, and we found a copy of CPA Schedule Number 1.
Hmm.
So that was quite something. That was 1942, 43, of course.
Right.
Yeah, well, it's been good talking to you, Mr. Finney.
Well, I've enjoyed talking with you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for calling.
You bet.
Good morning, talk back.
Hello, John. I was very interested in Mr. Finney's talk, that is, but into work I didn't get it all.
Mm-hmm.
But I brought the first engineer up the river. I believe his name was Mr. Stoddart, from Whitehorse to the old dam.
Mm-hmm.
And then the survey crew come in and they eat at the old dam. We were 2E. 1E, I think, was opposite General Enterprises gravel pit now. 2E was the old dam, 3 was McClintock River.
What are these? Your
construction camps.
See. For the building of the highway.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And number 4 was at Marsh Lake, and 5 was up at Jake's Corner.
Mm-hmm.
Jake's Corner, of course, was called after, it was either Colonel Jacoby or Captain Jacoby.
That's interesting to me. I never knew that.
The Stoddart, I think, was the first engineer up in that direction before anything was in.
That would have been in early 42 or 41?
Yes, spring of 42.
And perhaps you can tell me after whom Johnson's Crossing was named. What Johnson was that?
No, I couldn't tell you that. There was an old chap around here, Ernie Johnson. That could have been him. I don't know, an old prospector in that neck of the woods.
And then we had a welder on the Canal Project who acquired the nickname Moose Johnson. He was called Moose Johnson because, by mistake, he shot a cow moose.
Yep.
And the Mounties nabbed him for it, and he was known forever after as Moose Johnson.
I remember the name all right. Well, you know Bob Watson and Carcross? Mm-hmm. Well, Bob and
yeah.
I ran boat. We hauled supplies up the river before the bridges were in.
Yeah. Well, George Simmons is my particular friend in Carcross.
Yeah.
I also knew the parrot, and I think I was the last man to photograph the parrot before he died.
Yeah.
I hope that my taking his picture didn't hasten his end.
The contractor with us was Bergstrom and Ramstead.
Yeah.
It was the Canall, the Alcan, and the Cantel.
Right. Sir, we thank you very much for calling.
Okay.
And adding your comments.
Bye-bye.
We're hoping to have George Simmons on the Talkback Show. George is in Hawaii right now, where he winds up every year for a couple of months anyway.
Yeah.
But he is a fantastic storyteller and has some really fine stories for us. And
Polly
was a particularly good friend of mine. I used to live in Carcross when I first
came
to
Yukon. Did you ever get your finger bitten by him?
Polly used to let me scratch her head. That was sort of a privilege. There were a few people that could, and I was one of them.
You're saying he, which one's right?
What was the sex, or do you know?
I don't know. I never
at this
got that
point,
involved.
It's probably a she or she.
Well, he, she, or it let me scratch the head also.
Mm-hmm.
His, her, or its head.
Must
have been a she.
Well, just before we wind up, we're going to take a... Oh, we're going to take a commercial break, then we'll be back to wind up in just a couple of minutes.
The White Horse Inn is probably familiar to you, but let me take you for a quick tour. In here, we have the restaurant. And in here, we have the Gold Nugget Lounge. Then around here, we have the tavern. Now upstairs, where it's quiet, we have single and double rooms, comfortably appointed and carpeted wall to wall. All this for your enjoyment at the White Horse Inn on Main Street.
Come look at Woolworth, big, bright, and new. The fun place for shopping, terrific values too.
January isn't the only month of bargains at Woolworth. February brings a whole new flock of sale-priced merchandise. Snowmobile suits for boys sizes 8 to 16 that were over $14 are just $8.88. For that same low price, Woolworth also has girls' snowmobile suits and boys' ski jackets. Winter outerwear for children sizes 4 to 6X has been drastically reduced. For example, a two-piece snowsuit with matching mitts is now the low, low price of $9.88. For children in this size range, there are bargains galore at Woolworth this week. Men's ski jackets are only $8.88, and the wood down-fill parka is now $79.88. Shop Woolworth now.
It's time to shop Woolworth. There's more than ever before in your fun-filled Woolworth store. Go Woolworth.
Going to wind up, and we've only got 30 seconds. Dick Finney, thank you very, very much for being with us on Talkback. It's been a most interesting hour and a half.
I have enjoyed it very much because I have the feeling that our listeners are especially knowledgeable and appreciate whatever it is I've said.
And Helen Horback, thank you again for coming with us on Talkback. We will look forward to having you again.
I'm going to get here by myself sometime so I can talk all the way through.
Real good. And that's been our Talkback program for Monday, February 5th. We'll be back tomorrow at 11 o'clock with Joyce Hayden, and we're going to talk about the status of women and probably women's libs, so get geared up for it. Until tomorrow at 11 o'clock, this is John Dumas saying thank you very much for being with us and have a real good day.
The opinions and views expressed on Talkback are not necessarily those of the station, staff, or management at CKRW or WHTV. Talkback is meant for the free expression of the public and returns tomorrow at 11:05.